A very interesting learning experience for me. Basically, my job was to. Well, I started. I don't know how I started. I think we met in Starbucks at some point, like many months ago. And I was telling you, I know I want to change in fields and all this, and you told me, oh, he's doing something with economics. And then I got to meet Mike and Jim and Zoe and somehow that all this we started this sort of collaboration. I was trying basically to understand what they were trying to say and trying to put it in a little bit more mathematical, formal way, and a little bit the models that they were trying to construct. And so this is somehow the result, part of the result. I'm not going to be able to present everything, but I want to present some kind of layout of sort of class of models that I've been thinking about, and also with some collaboration with Simone and Severini. And this, the cool thing about this model is that it allows you to do analytic calculations. So most of it will be equation, unfortunately. But the cool thing is that I think that many of these agent-based models can be collapsed into very few parameters. And I believe there's some universality classes of models that even though you might have very complicated rules for the dynamics of the agents, at the end of the day, if you want a coarse grain, if you really want to make questions about the macroeconomics, it should boil down to very few parameters. And this is something we like in physics. You know, the standard model of particle physics has 21 parameters, but you can build bigger models like the MSSM, 120 parameters, and why would you do that? Unless the data tells you to do so. So sometimes it's good to have simplicity. So when I prepared this, I was thinking of talking a little bit about the thing that I'm thinking about with Farinelli, but yesterday I talked about this part here of non-equilibrium dynamics in finance, so I'm going to consider now the part of the non-equilibrium dynamics in some macroeconomics. So some of the questions that I'm going to be addressing, what are the symmetries of the economic system, what is the space of Bayesian equivalent equilibrium of the economy, and I'll tell you what the gauge symmetry is. Actually very simple, simply the change of measuring units, just like the gauge symmetry that I was talking about yesterday. And so the main point here is to study small fluctuations around an equilibrium. If I give you any equilibrium of the economy, how do I set up the problem of this is what we call perturbation theory in physics. And it's very important in physics. Usually most systems, we understand them like this. String theory is an example. Particle physics, we also do perturbation theory. And the ideas and the tools that I'm going to use are very much inspired by some work that I've done in fluid dynamics. So it's really, I'm trying to set up some kind of fluid dynamic theory of interacting agents. So one of the main things, and this is what Simone also was very involved in this, is the role of the trading network topology. There's been a lot of talks in the literature of, you know, if I have different topologies in the network between agents, if I have a complete graph or ring, this might make a big difference, but in reality, we found that there's not much difference. That there's some kind of universality in the relaxation to equilibrium. And so, what is the relaxation time to equilibrium? And I'm going to be using the example of a pure exchange economy, so I'm not going to talk about production until the end if I have some time. Although I did in my previous work, so this is the list of references. This is the latest paper with Simone, and this is the first paper where I actually sort of translated some of the things of the particle model to this mathematical framework. And in this paper, yeah, I did production and I addressed the question of the emergence of money. And I'm not going to talk about it here. But so you can see some of these models as a possible building block. We were talking about this Manhattan Project of having some maybe building blocks that we can plug in into a bigger model. You can see this as a possibility of one of those building blocks. And the cool thing is that it allows very fast numerical simulations. So again, this is the inspiration for this model. So here's the basic picture. Yesterday I was mostly in this part of sort of macro, the macro theory in the financial terms. You have only a few variables, prices, spot rates. But now I want to concentrate on the down part of this image. So I would be asking questions about the interactions of the agents. So in this case, we have a well-defined concept. Excuse me, was that a question? Oh, okay.
We have a well-defined concept of equilibrium, but we have a poor understanding of the non-equilibrium dynamics. And so one of the main questions is, there any basic principles to build in some model out of equilibrium? And the things that I'm going to be presenting are inspired by kinetic theory. And again, non-equilibrium economics, usually you can put all the agent-based models are, by definition, non-equilibrium. So I'm looking for something more, a little bit more tractable and with some level of analytical tractability. So let me introduce the notation. I'm going to be using N agents. And there will be no evolution of biological evolution agents. Will be number of agents will be fixed by simplicity. And also the number of products will be fixed, in this case, by simplicity. So I haven't addressed the problem of innovation, which is very interesting, but I'll be happy to talk about it. So I'm going to denote I'm going to use the Greek letters to label the number of agents and the Latin letters to label products. So something like Ni alpha is the number of product I that agent alpha has in whatever units you want to use. So there's a symmetry principle because we don't want the dynamics of the economy to depend on the units that we use to measure the different products. So that means that there's a scaling symmetry. If I take the portfolio of all the agents and I scale it by some positive function, it could be a function of time, there's an equivalence relation between Ni and Ni tilde if they're related by a positive factor. So there's an equivalence class that we have to take into account. Now, the other ingredient of the models that I study is some index of satisfaction. This was a lot of debate because many of the agent-based models, you don't really use utilities. You really use some complicated set of rules. But I believe that at some level, you can simplify a lot of that by introducing an index of satisfaction that could be different for different agents, and it could be time-dependent. You can have changing preferences. And I will give you an example of a changing preference model later. And so the assumption is that this index of satisfaction depends on the inventory of products that agent alpha has and on probably in time. And it has this basic properties. And this is the derivative with respect to product I. So it's an increasing function of the number of products. So if you have more product, you're happier. And it's a concave function and has this property. It's more for technical reasons. So basically, it's a convex function. I haven't specified. I will give you a specific model. So you have this is sort of the basic setup, and then you have a lot of flexibility how to construct models. So the other thing is that agents might. So in this model, yeah, go. Because it could be an expectation of your utility with some information that you have. So in some of the models, not in the ones that I'm going to consider here, but in the, you can call it whatever you want, but in the first paper, some of this index of satisfaction was like an expectation given the information of the time t of your utility. So it was very much inspired on risk management, you know, and how you use utilities in risk management. You can call it utility. Yeah, okay, I can call it utility. It's just in the books, and when you read books about risk management, usually they call index of satisfaction the expectation of the utility, or happiness, or whatever you want. Yeah, okay, it's utility. But it's not utility on consumption. This is very important. It's utility on the amount of products that you have. So this is a distinction on some economic models. So agents can have an opinion on the relative values of products. And again, I want to make the statement that prices do not exist in this model unless you trade. So there's no such thing as a global price for anything. Prices are simply the relative flow of products in the economy. However, people can have an opinion of what they think the relative value of their products are. And this is sort of part of the utility function. It's not meant to mean that this is the price of something. That there's no. As you will see, prices are really emergent in this kind of model. So I'm just going to assume that this matrices that I think Mai used to call the what-by-what matrices, simple exchange rate matrices, are consistent in that they obey this basic relation. Each person can have their own matrix. It depends on the model, and they can have different opinions. I'm going to give you an example where they start with the random opinions, and they learn. So. All right, so because we don't want any scale dependency in the index of satisfaction, the utility has to be dimensionless, or at least the model should be invariant under if you shift the utilities by a common factor. So to say that more mathematically, we assume that the partial derivative of the utility with respect to product I has to transform in this way under a gauge transformation. So it basically transforms as a covector. And this watt by watt matrices or exchange rate, they have to transform this way under the gauge transformation. So that these things, this kind of relations will give you some constraints on the possible form of the dynamics that you can have. Now, this is sort of a newer part. In the last paper, we were trying to do a model where we don't really specify too much of the details how the agents interact. So we will treat the interactions probabilistically. So here, sigma alpha beta ij is the probability per unit time that agent alpha encounters beta and make an exchange involving products I and j. Basically like some kind of cross-section in physics. I don't have yet. So okay. You can say that it's it will be r plus to the p. Yeah. Yeah. Just unit transformation. No, it could be time dependent too. Yeah. So and actually, there's an equivalence class even at different times. So if you have an economy here that is measured in different units from an economy at some other time, they're equivalent. I will say more about that. So it's an equivalence relation. So it's kind of a strong statement. All right, so let me then describe the equilibrium landscape. In this pure exchange economy, the equations that describe equilibrium are simply this. So what it means is that imagine that I want to do a trading between any two products at some rate. This is MIJ is basically the rate of trading, which is an exchange rate. But remember, this is sort of the realized exchange rate. So this is an exchange rate in equilibrium, let's say. So I am already satisfied with what I have. So I'm maximized with respect to this exchange between product I and J, and the same with any other product. So the solution to this equation should be zero for delta and I equals to zero. So this gives you the basic equations that describe the equilibrium, the space of equilibrium of this model. And so the first thing that we want to ask is how much we can learn from scale invariants and these equations. And again, there are many equations here. This is for all I and j and the number of products. So it could be supposed to be p products and alpha from 1 to n, the number of agents. Yeah.
It's about m. Is m just some random matrix you're going to assign? And you refer to it in one hand as an exchange rate. So I would thought that would have depended on the cross section. On another hand, you're referring to it as a valuation of some kind.
All right. So yeah, there are different ones. So this one here, I'm not going to talk about this till more at the end. So the one that I'm putting here is not the evaluation one. This one is
okay.
This one is the realized one. So suppose that I have a market that there's some, you know, I go to an agent. I'm agent alpha. I go to an agent beta and try to make a barter trade. And I will give you the solution to the barter problem. But suppose that the solution is, you know, the price that we negotiate is m. That is what I mean by it. So in equilibrium, there will be a single price that they will reach. And they will agree on this price. So if I try to barter with him, it's going to be at the same price, and with her at the same price. And then we're all satisfied already. So it's a bit sort of a boring situation. But that's the equilibrium. But the thing to understand is the equilibrium can be time dependent in the sense that imagine that you have sort of smoothly evolving time utilities, or you put a source in the system. But it's a smooth source, so that the space of equilibrium can be smoothly evolving. So it doesn't mean equilibrium doesn't mean that it has to be static in that sense. So what it means is that they will be trading, but infinitesimally.
So at an equilibrium point, there is a global inter-agent M.
Yes.
But does that enforce unique M's on the internal M?
No.
Internal? Okay.
No.
So.
Yeah. The first example that I will give, they don't have an internal M. They only, their utility is simply the log of the sum of the log of the different products. So they're insensitive to the relative values. So it depends on the model, but it doesn't have to.
And what do the agents use the M for, their internal M?
You'll see. It's, you know. And that is a model dependent statement if they depend on that, and if they have an opinion, they might not have one, but in some models they do. So anyways, I want to skip the details, but you can show simply using the symmetries of these equations, the scale invariance, that the space of gauge inequivalent, so the number of the equivalent classes of equilibria in the spear exchange economy is isomorphic to the following group, which R plus is simply the real line, but positive real line, and N is the number of agents. So if you take N to infinity, this is simply the wealth distribution of the economy. So, yeah.
This is equilibrium in the physics sense of equilibrium, right? We're in a statistical mechanical sense, or thermodynamics?
No, I think it's in that sense there.
In the sense that...
Okay.
So it's not in the physics sense, I think it's in the economic sense.
Right, okay.
Well, maybe it were an entropy, then that would be...
No, but it's not, yeah, not entropy, no. This is like in the pure economic sense. So at any point in time, and we learned that just by simple scale invariance, that the space of Gaussian equivalent equilibrium is simply the wealth distribution. So two economies that have the same wealth distribution, they're exactly the same, the complete equivalent, and this is something that you might have expected. Now, what happens if we want to go out of equilibrium? So, what is perturbation theory? It has many names. In physics, we usually think of it as a description of small fluctuations around equilibrium. Again, equilibrium in physics is a bit different from the equilibrium in economics, but I think in a lot of senses is similar. So, in physics, sometimes you have some potential and some scalar field, and you want to, you know, this is an equilibrium, but some of them are unstable. If you're sitting here and there's a small perturbation, you might roll to one of the other minima of the potential. So this is something that we would like to understand from the economic point of view. If you have an equilibrium, an economic equilibrium, if you make a small perturbation, will the perturbation start growing or will it decay? And if it decays, what is your final equilibrium state that you will go to? Does it depend on the initial condition? Is it universal? This is the kind of question that we would like to answer. And does it depend on the network topology? So the way we do this is we simply decompose some trajectory. Suppose this is a general non-equilibrium trajectory of the portfolio of some agent alpha. And imagine there's an equation like this for every I, for every alpha. And we take some arbitrary one-parameter family of equilibria, and we decompose this guy in terms of this equilibria and some flux deviation from that equilibrium. And again, in physics, it's very important to identify what we call Gaussian invariant variables. What it means is these are variables that actually describe the physical perturbation, and you cannot somehow rescale them away by making a gauge transformation. So it's very trivial here to find those variables. We just decompose this delta and I alpha in terms of this x. So this x here is a dimensionless gauge invariant variable, and we want to describe the evolution of this guy. And so perturbation theory is an approximation where this guy is small. So we approximate our equation to linear order in x. So without going too much into the details, at the end of the day, you find that the mean field theory equation for the perturbation takes this form in terms of the probabilities of the interactions. And some kind of, here, this expressions, I'm going to say a little bit more about them, but this is basically the solution to the bartering problem. This is the amount of the product I and J that agents alpha and beta will exchange under the assumption that they're close to equilibrium between each other. And I will show that in the edge work box in the next slide, but just to give you a flavor of how this depends on the utilities of agent alpha and beta. And delta is this difference in utilities. And here, again, n bar is the...
Cardinal? You're saying cardinality? Well, you're adding them, I'm just noticing.
Oh, no. So, that's a good point. I don't add them in the usual sense, so remember that all of them come in with derivatives. So what it means, this is a good thing. So what it means, so for instance, this guy, what it really means is the derivative of ni alpha, the alpha plus the derivative ni beta, omega beta. So I'm adding the derivatives because there's no meaning in comparing two utilities. But this guy and this guy transform in as the covector under the gauge transformation, so it's something that I can compare to. So everything here involves derivatives, so nothing depends on the actual scale of the utility function. So now the task is to study this equation. It's not very explicit here, but this equation is actually linear in x on the right-hand side. And it will depend on the model. It depends on what utility you put. It could be any complicated utility. You might need to also specify the evolution of the preferences. And
what should the relative utility? Different people may have different scales of their utility as well, right? Why should you be able to add those across different?
That's why only the gradients count.
Those could scale also, right?
This guy transforms under gauge transformation like this. So basically, utility is dimensionless. It's a number that just.
I was interpreting that as the items can be rescaled. So that gauge transformation
is under gauge transformation, the utility function can at most change by something that is independent of the product. So if I make a gauge transformation, this guy should transform something that might be a function of time, but it has to be independent of the products.
But maybe just to rephrase the question, does it deal with the problem that I might like tomatoes more than you like tomatoes, so I might get more utility from eating tomatoes? Mm-hmm. And so, when we're going out and making our decision about where the equilibrium sits, we have to deal with, you might just like everything, right? So all of your, and are you saying we can allow, I guess what we're getting, wondering is this a Pareto optimum? In some sense, or like a Pareto optimum,
this is
like Bentham, who just said, just have to say, everybody has to have the same.
All right, so I should probably explain a little bit of how you get to this result, but it doesn't assume that everybody has the same scale. It's actually invariant under that. Different agent might even value their portfolios in different units. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the same scale, but the fact is that. Just because this guy transforms as the same as this guy, you can add two vectors, but the actual scale of the utility, in fact, this thing is scale. If you scale all the utilities by the same number, doesn't matter. But this is the solution to the Bartering problem between two agents. I'm not making assumptions about the Pareto efficiency of the whole economy, but there's a very well defined problem when two agents want to trade. Let's suppose you're agent alpha. And let's say you have product one, and let's say that you want to make a delta one here, right? And product two, and there's some exchange rate, and then you have the utility of agent beta. And it's minus delta n one because there's product conservation. So I'm not comparing anything, but the way that I do it is let me fix the price. It's very simple. And then let me calculate what will be the delta N1 that will maximize this guy. What will be the delta N1 that will maximize this guy and just equate them. So I can do this with a different delta N1 and just equal supply and demand. It's the simple equilibrium. Basically, they reach an equilibrium between each other. And this is the solution to that problem. It doesn't matter how each other measure their utilities. So I know it can be confusing from here, but So intuitively, this is what happened in the edge work box. If there, so suppose that this is agent alpha equals satisfactions, and this is agent beta. So in this case, obviously, there's no way that both of them can benefit. But if there's a niche like this, then they can move in this direction and have a trait that would benefit both of them. And perturbation theory means that we assume that this area here is small enough, so we can make an approximation to linear order in this delta n1. Basically, I'm expanding this equation to linear order in delta n1. Actually, to quadratic, I'm taking this guy minus, so I'm taking this guy minus the original utility, this delta, let me call this delta alpha, and I take this guy, expand to second order in delta 1, and solve for the maximization problem, do the same for this guy, and equate the supplies and demand. So this is the solution to the bartering problem. And you can do it to any order. You can keep going and computing corrections to this.
I have a question. It seems to me that there's an infinite number of, I mean, take any size perturbation in terms of just magnitude of a vector, maybe a distance away from that 0, 0. There's an infinite number of possible bargaining solutions. I've raised this with Lee too. There's an infinite number of bargaining solutions. I mean, they're going to be happy anywhere in that green area. I mean, frankly, either one of them is going to be better off than at 0, 0. So how do you, I mean, in economics, we treat that as a bargaining problem. We don't treat that as a deterministic. There's no way you can enter deterministically into that green region.
This is a good question. And it turns out at the linear level, at the linearized level, all the solutions are the same. I would claim that all of them are the same. You can do it.
Well, I understand, because if I end up halfway, you know, it could be a guy, very aggressive guy that's red, who has a credible threat point and gets me to basically be over there on the far intersection point, versus a guy that's not aggressive, where I have the credible threat point, where I say, I'm going to walk away if you don't trade with me, and I get him to trade on my best point. So I don't. In other words, the furthest distance away from my...
Yeah, you say that you can end up right here or here. But the thing is that at the linear level, at the linearized approximation, you can show that all these solutions look the same.
But linearization is only going to... I can still put a line through 0, 0 that has any slopage between the two limit points.
But I will tell you that the difference of the slope... So if you put something like this, an extreme like this, then this guy will be gaining nothing.
That's a possibility.
No, but I mean from this, I mean if let's suppose that there's a, so the approach here is to take, suppose that there's a final price to this, and that price has to maximize this thing.
In fact, there's a bid-ask spread.
Oh, I'm not.
But
yeah, okay.
It really is. I mean, when you talk about going into that green region, there's a.
I'm ignoring any kind of. I mean, this.
There is a spread, and the spread is only reduced to 0 if you make some additional assumption. That's all I'm trying to say. You're making an additional, quite understand, but you seem to be making an additional assumption to get rid of the indeterminacy caused by the fact that any point in that green interior is going to actually be Pareto improving over 0, 0. So you're not maximizing. It's a game problem. In other words, it's not an optimization. It's a game problem.
So the other way...
Let me help you out for a second.
The other way...
Can I help for just one second? The amazing thing is, you're going to see, that although some of the assumptions in these two models, the one you saw before Jim and Bruce did and Sam's, are quite different, that some of the results are more similar than you would have ever expected.
Yeah, but
there's one way to derive this solution, but it's the same as this problem. It turns out to be the same as this solution. One way is to assume that it's a what's called egalitarian Nash equilibrium. So
Nash, right.
So that delta omega alpha equals delta omega beta. So that was the first thing that I did. The first thing that I did, they both gained the same.
If you have these credible threat points, you can move that solution around to almost anything you want in the green circle, green lens. Yeah.
But let's suppose that you assume that delta omega alpha equals delta omega beta. There's a unique solution to that, and this is the solution. The other way to do it is like this. Suppose that they negotiate a price, whatever it is. I would maximize this guy into the linear approximation. To the linear approximation, these solutions are exactly the same.
You're saying independent of credible threat points.
Yes.
I think one way to think about it is, so we've been bargaining, right? And I've been selling you one apple. I've been giving you one apple, and you've been giving me three oranges. Yeah. And we're at a point where, you try to increase the price a little bit, you know, we're right at the margin, so if you increase the price a little bit, my demand will change. So if I get an additional 1/1000th of an apple, I can try and withhold that from you, but the amount by which it'll change the price is second order in that perturbation. So I think the first order, I'm best off just fully trading. And these bargaining opportunities, I think, are second order in the perturbation. Yeah.
And maybe I don't understand the purpose of the perturbation, but I mean, if you're going to
make it, we can talk more later.
Matters,
we can talk more later. At the end of it, look.
I don't think you're going to get dynamics out of equilibrium.
No. Look, at the end of the day, you can say.
Small, but nothing happens. I don't think there's dynamics.
At the practical level, we can talk about the assumption again. There are two ways of driving, and you get the same result at the linearized level. But if you have any doubts about it, you just take this as a kind of fluid equation for this economic system. So there is a solution to the bargaining problem. I claim that these questions are second order, but this is a solution to the bargaining problem. You can take it as the solution when you assume egalitarian. Both of them have the same gain. But you can prove it some other way, and it gives you the same result. But let's take this. This is the dynamic equation. As long as you can give me some other solution, just plug it here. But this is the solution that I'm taking, and I drive it in two different ways.
Let me just try one more question, okay?
Right.
So I understand what you're doing. The way I interpret the word nonlinear dynamics is there has to actually be a
nonlinear dynamics. You said nonlinear dynamics.
Yeah.
This is linear dynamics.
Well, I mean, non-equilibrium dynamics, I'm sorry.
Oh, my mistake.
Right. But what I mean is, I guess I'm thinking it's a different terminology, because when I think of the word non-equilibrium dynamics, I'm expecting to see discrete perturbation, I mean, really distant perturbations. I'm not expecting to see infinitesimals. I mean, I'm expecting to see a theory of how the agents act out of equilibrium. I'm not expecting to see tiny little infinitesimal. So that's my problem, I think. You're doing infinitesimal.
This is fine. This is what we do in string theory. This is what we do in fluid. The people that are simulating the fluids in the Rick Collider in New York, this is what.
But there still is not a theory of how agents act.
No. You're right. We're totally the same page in this. So this is my point. There are two levels. I think your level is to go to to the people's preference and really like simulate the real.
Just put them discreetly at a different point.
Right. And go and ask people, survey and all.
What do they do? Yeah, that's
fine.
The issue. Yeah.
My level, I'm a little bit more macroscopic, so I'm trying to brush out. My claim is many of these models with very complicated rules and this rule for this guy interacting with this can be described at a more macroscopic level with just simple utilities and some heterogeneous preferences. So I'm basically coarse graining a lot of this. I don't want to ask questions about complicated dynamics.
In economics, others can correct me if I'm wrong, but we would call this stability testing of an equilibrium point. We would not call it non-equilibrium dynamics, okay? Because we would be expecting to see a theory.
Maybe I could just jump in. I mean, where he's heading is that it's fluctuating around the equilibrium. And you want to understand things like, how big are those fluctuations?
Do they grow?
Like in the financial market, financial markets are not perfectly efficient.
But if it is
in some sense close to equilibrium, so that you can do this kind of stuff, how big of fluctuations do you expect? Now, you haven't really explained where the noise is going to come from.
But wouldn't you call that a stability analysis around equilibrium? You wouldn't call it
it's different than stability analysis, because I actually want to know how big the fluctuations are. I don't want to just know whether it's stable or not. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay,
you want to know how they relax.
He's not answering the question.
But it's not in equilibrium.
It's a different question.
It's not in equilibrium.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's a question that's potentially answerable. So
I'm not saying it's not an interesting question. I'm just saying that as me as an economist looking at it, I'm expecting something completely different than I'm seeing. So I just think.
Well, maybe, I don't know, but it's not in equilibrium. I mean, the system is, I'm considering a fluctuation from equilibrium. It's not in equilibrium. That's why I call perturbation theory. Let's go on.
But you're arbitrarily close to equilibrium.
It's the same thing we do in physics. We take the first order correction, and whatever that is, we see it's a self-consistent thing. You take the first order correction, do the dynamics, do they grow? If they grow, you're screwed. You have to go to the next order. Maybe the next order will take them back.
Samuelson's correspondence principle.
The what?
Samuelson's correspondence principle from foundations of economics.
Plato had it.
So, for instance, one can ask questions. So, one of the things is that in this approach, you can ask a little more general questions. Instead of simulating things, you can say, let's do some more simplified assumptions to see if I start with a perturbation, what will happen in the infinite future? What will be the final equilibrium state? Would it, you know, assume, let's assume that it goes to some equilibrium state. So this is just a simpler case just to drive a more general result. So if I assume that the index of satisfaction is time dependent in any of the equilibrium states, it can be time dependent outside of equilibrium. But in any of the equilibrium states, it's time independent and everybody has the same form of the index of satisfaction in equilibrium, then one can prove a theorem that says that given an initial perturbation, the final well distribution or the final the final equilibrium state is independent of the dynamics of the non-equilibrium theory and is independent in particular of the probabilities and dependent of the network where the agents are interacting. And you know, you might think that, so this is a very special case, but it's interesting that you can actually prove this just by looking at this equation, and you find out that in this linearized approximation, there are some conserved quantities that are not very obvious from these equations, and you can show that just using conserved quantities without going into the details of the dynamics. So this is the kind of thing that we as physicists like, that we can derive some more general statement without having to make. Yeah.
Just be sure I understand your statement. So the thing you're perturbing are the n sub i's, or you're perturbing something else. And when you say probability, you mean the probability distribution of
this guy, the probability of interacting. Not the probability distribution.
All right.
So we take a probabilistic point of view that agents interact probabilistically, but it's not the same as the distribution of wealth or anything like that.
And the network is, they aren't just colliding. The network is determined by what?
By the
non-zero values?
Yeah, because they might be, so this guy might be non-zero only if alpha and beta are neighbors in some
right.
network. So that's, so it's independent of all these details. All right, so let me see what is the role of the training network if we want to have something a little bit more interesting. So to do this, we consider the simplest case of this utility function, which is scale invariant, so it obeys the things that we want. And we consider this kind of probability. So this A alpha beta is the what is called the adjacency matrix of the graph. It means that it's one only if alpha and beta are basically nearest neighbors in the graph. So for instance, you can have a complete graph, you can barely see here, but everybody's connected with everybody. This is a ray graph, and so D here is the degree of the graph. So everybody here has four neighbors, and everybody here has only two neighbors. So this is D, and P is the number of products. So for this simple system, you can show that perturbation equation reduces to this linear equation. And just from studying this equation, you can find that all of the modes are stable. So all the eigenvalues, you can write this as a eigenvalue equation, and all the eigenvalues are positive. And so the only role of the network in this case, and by the way, I assume that the agents choose the pair of products to trade at random for simplicity, just to focus on the effect of the network. So the effect of the network here is only to determine the relaxation time. So the relaxation time is on linear function on the what's called the eigenvalue gap of the adjacency matrix. So you take the eigenvalue gap of this matrix, and that determines the relaxation time. And it turns out that networks with more nodes, like the complete graph, they have a bigger eigenvalue gap, so they relax faster. So this is basically the only effect of...
Don't you have instability when you've got positive?
That's the problem, that you can prove that there are no positive eigenvalues. They're positive, there's a negative here. So
the negative sign is to make it stable.
This is just the definition. So gamma is a positive number.
You have to have gamma be positive, so you put the negative sign in front to get the thing you see.
No, this is a result. I mean, I just didn't want to write the whole thing, but you can show that the eigenvalues are such that it's stable. So. No. The negative sign follows. I mean, just solve this equation, right? So, this equation has the form of a.
I think what he's asking, delta lambda is the gap between the lowest and the first.
Oh, yeah. It's order already.
By definition, that's always positive.
By definition, it's always order, yeah. And actually, yeah, and the eigenvalues are always between minus 1 and 1.
in the case of this adjacency matrix. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that.
So here I want to compare how this mean field theory approximation compares with actual simulations. You can put agents on graphs and make them interact, and with the same rules that they exchange products using the solution to the bartering problem. And you can do this at random. Basically here, this is an example. I think this simulation is for the complete graph. So basically we generate pairs of agents at random and make them barter. And this is one of the gauge invariant perturbations as a function of time. And the dashed lines are for the complete graph. And the other lines, the solid lines, are for the cycle. So you can see it's not very big difference that the network topology makes, because here you see that the complete graph relaxes faster. It takes a little more to the cycle graph to relax, but it's not really a big difference. But you see that the mean field theory approximation is pretty good, you know, at later times to describe the sort of the mean of the fluctuations. Now you can have more complicated examples where you have changing preferences. So in this is the case where
Five minutes.
All right. So this is the case where you have this what-by-what matrix entering into the utility function. So this is an agent who has the utility depends on the relative values of the different products. And this is an opinion that the agent has. So every agent will have a different opinion. And this is just a number from 0 to 1 to ensure that this utility obeys the basic rules that we assume. And in equilibrium, this thing will go to something like this, where you have a common price to everybody. So now we need to provide some equations for this preference. We need to simulate to say how would the agents change their preferences as they trade. So a simple model that you can come up with is that once two agents find each other and they trade, they will update their internal preferences based on the price that they just found out, the ratio of the products that they just bartered, which is given by this formula in the leading approximation. And then one can define a gauge invariant variable for the preference, basically for the what-by-what matrix. And one can derive a set of equations. This is for x for the perturbation in product number, and this is y for the perturbation in the preference. And t alpha beta is given in terms of the probabilities like this. And so you now have a bigger system of equations. But again, the same technique, you can show that the system is stable. And you can sometimes, you can here simulate, for instance, this is the case, the solid lines are for the case of the unchanging preferences, the first example that I showed. And this is the case for the changing preferences with this parameter nu equals 0.9. So as nu, this parameter nu here in the utility function, as it goes to 1, basically these agents are profit maximizers. And when they become profit maximizers, the relaxation time goes to infinity, and the system never really relaxes. It starts oscillating and oscillating like crazy, and it never really reaches an equilibrium. So only for nu less than 1. And so, the relaxation time is governed mainly by that parameter. And I can tell other models that I built. This is to simulate these transformations, also inspiring the particle model. How much, if you have an agent has the capability of transforming two products into a third product, how much should they produce? So again, you can assume it's sort of a near equilibrium state and get some approximate equation for the production process, but you have to include this new conversion rates, or this is like the technology of the agent. And well, this is kind of a big mess here for the formula, but the point is that these formulas are very easy to implement numerically. And so they lead to fast codes. You can put them in a bigger simulation. And also you can have some kind of centralized market maker which takes orders, but it's a very very toy model of a market maker. Anyway, I'm out of time, so I'm just gonna conclude here. So this is basically a semi-analytic approach to agent-based economic markets, and so the main thing is to study stability of the equilibria, see what is the space of equilibria. And the models have enough flexibility to simulate changing preferences or other more complicated things that you would like to model. And again, the prices are only, they only exist after a trade. There's no such thing as a global price. It simply describes the relative flow of products in the economy. And you can also include external couplings. You can include products flowing in the economy. And actually, you see that sometimes if you make a product and you redistribute it with the largest variant, that product becomes like the currency, basically. But I don't have time to go into that. I can give you a reference. Anyway, so thank you for your attention.
Maybe just time for one or two questions.
I just wanted, you said something really interesting about the agents become profit maximizers and the relaxation time goes to infinity, but you were flying at that point. So
yeah, sorry. All right, so here for this utility function, the agents are now sensitive to the price. What they think is the price that they're. So this parameter here, if when it's less than one, basically ensures that they have a preference so that not all the products are the same for them. So when it's a profit maximizer, the agents tend to dump all one of the products that completely trade and get rid completely of one of the products. So this is basically, you can trace this to be the source of the instability. So if nu is less than one, basically this guy goes to infinity if, say, ni goes to zero. So they never deplete any of their products. So that basically the size of the trade is bigger and bigger as nu becomes, you know, closer to one. The thing is that when you go to one, you lose control of the perturbation theory. So the fluctuations become so big that you have to go to the next order. You cannot trust the perturbation theory. So that is the only caveat here.
So, which one is the log utility?
Yeah,
log utility. Which is an important special case.
Well, I tried to take another stab at the previous discussion. So I think your starting point is that if you have an equilibrium and you're doing economics like stability analysis, you do an infinitesimal perturbation. And then it doesn't matter which order you're doing because it's all small. So it's one, two, or whatever. But then you say what you're doing is not that. It's a finite perturbation. But you're just choosing to do that in a linear fashion,
yeah.
Which is also fine. But then what you're saying, and I think I agree, is that there's an arbitrariness in the way you do that in that green region. You can go linearly in many different ways. And then am I right to say that what you're saying is that, yes, you can, but then they all give the same result? In what sense?
All right, so suppose that I have, in the sense that there's a unique price that solves these equations. So let's suppose that I'm this guy. And let me assume that we reach an equilibrium. So somehow we negotiate some price, some angle of this line, some angle, right? So we reach this M. So let me now maximize this guy with respect to delta N1, right? And I get some solution in terms of M. Let me do the same for the other guy because of the assumption that this is an equilibrium, both of them have to be maximized independently. And let me get a solution for this guy. Now, in order for this to be a solution to the Bartesian problem, this delta ni here has to be minus this delta ni here. So when you equal them, there's a unique solution for n. But if you go to the next order, there's no uniqueness anymore. So then you start depending on the angle. So it seems to be sort of magical in that in this linearized approximation, if you play, I know it's a bit counterintuitive, but the other way to put it is that you sort of assume that it's egalitarian as a starting assumption and then use that and get the same result. But I don't know. I kind of like this kind of derivation. It seems very natural to me, so I took that solution. It might be that you might come up with something else, but I don't see how you can have both utilities maximize.
It's a game because they're saying it's a game. You don't.
Yeah, they're going to start.
But I remember, there's an interesting extension of your work. It's by Al Wilhite, maybe. When you have random matching, right, and you're getting networks don't really matter, there's this beautiful paper, agent-based modeling paper on network, trade on networks by Al Wilhite, in which he shows he has a regular lattice, small world network, completely connected network, and a locally disconnected network, and a locally overlapping network. And he shows if you really introduce the obvious extension here would be to let agents search for their partners right. instead of just random matching. Because, and then that takes into account how many neighbors do you have, and how fast and how thoroughly can information traverse across this network. And of course, disconnections or failure to overlap as much as other networks starts to really matter.
Yeah.
And what he shows quite different than you're indicating with the random matching, is that, for example, the small world network has very great properties here in allowing traversal of signals at relatively small transactions cost relative to the fully connected trade network. Certainly, the fastest convergence is with the locally disconnected, but then you get nowhere near the efficient price. So, and they really are, once you introduce search, which we all usually use an agent-based model, you know, for searching for partners, then the form of the networks begins to matter a lot. Okay, I can understand with random matching starting in an equilibrium that it won't show any difference. But in fact, I mean, if you're talking about searching for partners, searching for best price, the neighborhoods that you set up or the network that you set up that forms those neighborhoods is critical. And small world networks and other types of networks are showing that this local clustering and global reach really does have an impact.
I think that you could rephrase that as like basically allowing that probability matrix to be like a random matrix or something like that.
Yeah. So I know that a lot of people use random matching, okay, to get statistical results. But I mean, truly, the interesting thing here is, to me at least, is price discovery with active search. I mean,
In the first concept model, the thing is, I think one of the main things to get is the this is the linearized solution to the bartering problem can be seen as basically some kind of equation telling you how the products flow if you have a matching. It's very then easy to extend this and make them, you know, search or something to see who. But the point is that there's some analyticity that you can exploit and it might be useful because you don't have to really think about too many rules. It's very easy to get carried on, and you know, I agree. There's many interesting extensions that you can do, but it seems that sometimes I sort of looking for the simplest thing might be the best. Another question. Yeah.
So the fact that the first order there aren't bargaining opportunities, but the second order there are, does that mean that maybe if agents were more forward looking, there could be instabilities?
Yeah.
I realize that I don't want to trade today because I'll be able to squeeze a better deal out of you tomorrow.
Actually, there are examples of in the first paper, even example of a bubble crash, and it's because the agents will do basically they will speculate, and they could ignore completely one option here. For instance, I told them to update their price like this, but they don't have to. I mean, they might completely disregard this new information and have some noise information. And there's all kinds of extension. And when you do that, there was one that they will speculate on the price, and it will create a bubble and a crash. So yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of things that you can build on. I was just trying to get some basic building blocks where, you know, you can then put all these models and plugging and play, basically.
Okay, that's the last question.
Well, I guess, I don't know if you can contrast what you're doing with like a traditional neoclassical model. It seems like you've handled the utility a little bit differently. And also, it seems that you're not assuming rationality. But on the other hand, you are having kind of the network interactions mean that people are coming to like local equilibriums where effectively supply matches demand on each local link. So, and what would happen? Do you have any idea what would happen if? But would it make any difference if these agents were rational? I mean, they're finding the equilibrium anyway, right?
They're maximizing their preferences.
What?
But they don't have rational expectations. They have the minimal rationality to have a utility. So the minimal
rationality.
But they are boundly rational in the sense that they don't necessarily know what other agents are doing, or they might have biases.
They're rational within
their
spot. Yeah.
So, but yeah, I agree. So this is like a local. So again, it was inspired in fluid dynamics that you see some kind of local equilibrium state in each part of the fluid, but in reality, you know, it's only at that part. It doesn't have to be the same equilibrium as this other part. But yeah, when they interact, the assumption. The basic assumption here is that the relaxation time, the negotiation time between two agents is much shorter than the relaxation time of the whole economy, basically. So that you can see that as the main assumption.
that they will reach equilibrium much faster than the whole system will reach equilibrium. So you can approximate this process as instantaneously.
Okay, I think we need to move on at this point, but let's thank Sun again.